95% through, or you are 98% of the way through. The feedback from the other captains and people in the campaign suggests, however, that it is about complete. At 75% of our goal, in the city, the university is about $1,000 below its goal. I think you're aware of the high unemployment in the city. I think you're aware of the great economic instability and perception of same, which make fundraising extremely difficult. This year, the university has the potential to exert a great impact on the city and to realize a great benefit. And many of you have contributed very generously to the campaign. And on behalf of the agency, thank you very much. For those of you who may have overlooked your participation as yet, by following the convocation, Ms. Jean Rohde will be outside the door, and she will provide a pledge card. Should you choose not to do anything today, perhaps you care to visit with your colleagues at the university. By all means, feel free to send your materials over to my office on the second floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. One of the most alive programs on campus, which we are all averted in this particular year, is the museum. A year ago, I asked the library and the student affairs office to make a report on their activities, and I felt that the most timely report to us at this time would be the museum. To do that is Director Lou Rowinsky.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is two things. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the program that's going on at the museum, and then I'd like to show you a few slides showing a little bit about the new building that's going on. The museum's rather well known for its collections, its research activities, and its public service programs, but mostly beyond campus. On campus, we seem to be known mainly for traffic congestion in the summertime, the space we occupy in all different buildings here and there, and construction problems that are caused on the West Ridge when we have the road blocked or something of that kind. Like the library, we try and serve the whole campus, but we deal in objects rather than books and papers and manuscript materials. We cover a number of fields, as they do too, primarily in natural history and with cultural history materials. These materials are all used for teaching and for research and for public service. They're used beyond the campus by other agencies, state and federal agencies, other universities. Our public service activities reach out to communities throughout the state, and we serve the general public both with the public exhibit program, which you're all familiar with, and with the traveling exhibit program. Two common questions I get asked are, how many items are in the collection? And that's always a difficult one to answer because we're dealing with a variety of materials. It's kind of like asking somebody who owns a fruit and vegetable store, how many things have you got in there? You know, you don't know whether to count a bunch of grapes as, you know, 50 things or one. But I'll try and go through that and show you some of the materials as I talk about the collections. And we also have a problem in counting things because of the different ways in which they're cataloged. You count samples of plankton in an entirely different way than you would count one whale skeleton. And yet they both appear as items in the collection. The other question I get asked is how much of the collection's on exhibit. Since there are in total about 1.5 million items in all the collections, from that plankton to that whale skeleton, we don't show a very high percentage, and it's hard to give you a number. There'll be more, though, in the new building than there are now. Museum is administratively located directly under the chancellor on the campus. It's run by a director who has a staff of curators, technicians, and student assistants. These people many of them are part-time people with, or people with split appointments with academic departments. We rely on a great deal of student help. And we have a relatively small but quite stable staff. Permanent exhibit program, which you've seen, is the most obvious thing we do. It brings people to campus, and it occupies a great deal of space and is probably one of the main things that the university does. It reaches a great part of the community and also a great part of the public in general. We have visitors from all through the United States and the rest of the world, too. But we do more than that with the exhibit program, public service program. We deal with museum outreach program, where we try and go into public schools to go out to other organizations. We deal with school tours that come not only from the Fairbanks area, but come from other parts of the state here for special tours. And we have a traveling exhibit program, which is primarily graphic. You may have seen samples of it over in the Wood Center. There have been a series of them running there. And those exhibits reach out and go to over 50 communities or so every year. All of the collections, which are the basis for everything we do, work with students and faculty and in various teaching programs. We have a great deal to do with graduate students. The curators all spend a great deal of their time responding to public inquiries, all sorts of questions from, you know, what is this bug in the closet, to can you identify these specimens which we've collected in a particular place. The staff carries on lectures for various groups. They prepare information for exhibits. They carry on research activities in their specific field. They're supported by grants and contracts, and we have about $750,000 worth so far this year. I'd just like to briefly say something about each of the collections. The archaeological collection is the oldest and largest of our collections. Jim Dixon is a curator of that collection. It started in the late 20s, early 30s, with university-sponsored research expeditions to St. Lawrence Island under the direction of Otto William Geist. Probably the largest unit of material in our collections is material from St. Lawrence Island that was collected by him. There are over 63,000 catalog entries relating to those materials, and over 44,000 of those entries are just from the single site of Kukulik. Since 1970, the growth of the archaeological collection has increased under the impact of federal and state legislation, which requires salvage archaeology in the state. Materials from the Alyeska oil pipeline project are deposited in the museum, and that includes 22,000 catalog entries, or about 400,000 specimens. All of these things, like library books, need cataloging, but it takes a little more time and effort, I think, perhaps, to catalog all of the items involved in one of these accessions, since you're dealing with everything from microblades and waste flakes from sites to much larger materials. It takes us a great deal of time to catch up with some of the backlog that's never been cataloged appropriately. Current work in this area involves a work with OCS problem, on-site inventories, cultural resource surveys, with the Alaska Division of Aviation, for instance, as one of the state agencies we deal with when they're doing surveys of potential construction sites. And this year we'll be working on a survey of Fort Wainwright for the Army. The ethnographic collection, which is probably one of the more popular ones with the public and one that generates more public inquiries than any of the other, has about 13,650 objects. These are all made, used by Alaska Native peoples, and they date from about the turn of the century to the present. That includes things like 800 baskets from Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, Alaska basket and Tlingit beadwork, ivory carvings, Eskimo masks, and again, a large collection of material from St. Lawrence Island. We have a great deal of material, 300 or 520 items that were collected in a project that we ran in 1970 under a grant from National Endowment for the Humanities that allowed us to go out and collect materials dealing with Alaska's modern native material culture, and then put together some exhibits on that particular subject which toured the state. Dinah Larson's also serves as a curator for the history collection and the art collection. The history collection consists of over 2,600 items, and these range from everything like large things like Eielson's airplane, which has been in storage for many years, Russian-American materials, including two blockhouses, one from Kolmogorsk and one from St. Michael, which have also been in storage for years, two smaller things like fountain pens that Dr. Bunnell used to sign particular documents at the university. One of our latest things is a three-stamp mill that's was used in early mining operations in the Fairbanks area, and it's still sitting out in the hills here, and we've been trying to figure out how to get it back this coming summer. The art collection you may have seen on campus, a collection of lithographs by Fred McAtans hangs in the library where it's most visible to the public, but other paintings and drawings from the collection are hung in offices on campus because we haven't got a gallery or space to show them in the present building. The terrestrial vertebrate collection, which is located in this building at the moment, consists of mammals and birds. There are 3,670 skins and a few skeletons of birds there, and over 24,000 specimens of mammals. That includes skins, skulls, complete skeletons, and also includes things like cross sections of teeth and slides of reproductive tracts. All of these are used continually and referred to and have to be both accessible and available to the general public. A lot of the materials in this collection have come from cooperative programs with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, by graduate students working in the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit, and from other organizations. Bird collections rank nationally and by the American Ornithologists Union as Category 1, which is the largest category of collections in the United States. And the American Society of Mammalogists has recognized the mammal collection as meeting the requirements for a national repository. And current work with that material includes updating the present knowledge of birds of Alaska based on Gabrielson. A new publication is just coming out to supplement Gabrielson. There are cooperative studies going on now with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and with Fish and Wildlife Service. There's a crane survey and a mammal survey being sponsored by Northwest Gas in the Upper Tananaw Valley. The herbarium, which is located on the lower floor of the Chapman Building, consists of plant specimens that are preserved and mounted and stored in a systematic way. It's one of the collections that never appears in its present form in the exhibit area. They're pressed plants, they're on paper, or they're in envelopes, and they're not suitable for public display. And yet, there are over 77,000 specimens of those. And those are quite actively used. There are a couple of graduate students who just moved into the collection because that's where they have to be and where they need to work. It consists of two sections, non-vascular plants and then a vascular plant collection, and then there are ancillary collections being built up of seeds and pollen right now. That collection has been selected as a national resource collection by the American Society of Plant Taxonomists. Paleontology collection was also started by Otto Geist. In the 30s, he collected primarily in the interior in northern Alaska Pleistocene mammals. You've got approximately 3,100 large Pleistocene animals and about 2,000 smaller ones that are available for study. In 1970, when we got a permanent curator for that collection, we started collecting invertebrate paleontological materials and paleobotanical collections, and now we have about 12,000 fossil invertebrates and about 2,000 fossil plant specimens. That includes microfossil samples, too. Grant from the National Science Foundation has been supporting a great deal of research by Carol Allison, who's a curator, on newly discovered Alaska basal Cambrian and later protozoic biotas. We have a separate collection of approximately 400 specimens of Alaskan ore minerals, some of which are on exhibit. And then we have a special collection of Alaskan nuggets and placer gold specimens that's now mostly on display in the gold room. But more materials have been acquired there that will be shown in the new building. That collection sponsored and supported primarily by the Berry Holding Company in memory of C.J. Berry, who was a pioneer gold miner in this area. The aquatic collection was established in 1972. That was done with funding from the Sea Grant program. It originally consisted of the collection and the sorting and identification center, which has now become part of the Institute of Marine Science. George Mueller is the curator of that collection, and he's now located in Seward and has part of the collection there with him, and some of it is on campus here with people who are using it, particular parts of it for special work. The major direction research effort in the aquatic collection has been directed at producing a basic inventory of Alaska's marine flora and fauna. Not only has a collection been developed, but there's been a literature compilation which now covers over 6,500 references with a keyword index to help workers in that area. The new building, which is designed to bring together all of these collections, provide adequate workspace for these, and make all of these materials more accessible to both the public and university users, is kind of unique on campus. I think you've seen it. Its appearance is a little different from everything else. Its function is very specialized, and its funding is different from most other campus buildings. It was a direct appropriation from the state legislature. The state legislature appropriated $8 million for that building. The governor cut that appropriation to six, and it's with that $6 million and some additional funding that we've acquired that the present building is going up. The building is also unique in having a very sophisticated environmental and security system in it. It's designed to protect the materials both from loss to through robbery or other kinds of people-oriented problems, but also keep it from deteriorating as we keep it. The prime role of us in relation to the collection is to preserve these things for the future, and the environmental situation of the building will help us to do that. What I'd like to do is show you some slides of the new building, and then if there are any questions about what we're doing, I'd be happy to answer them. We'll start with some of the older building first. Some of you may remember our quarters on the third floor of the Eielson building. These were designed for classroom space originally. The museum moved here after having had successive homes in the old main building and then on the lower floor of the Eielson building. Just another couple of views. We're still using many of these showcases and the storage cabinets that are back there. Some of the showcases have been repainted and put on the base. Many of the same materials which were collected early on are shown here. We've improved our mammal exhibit since this time, and there'll be another major improvement, we hope, over where they're shown now. We were moved into the present building, which was designed as a gymnasium on the lower floor and a library on the upper floor, and built in about 1935. We moved in about 1964 into the lower floor. Our public seems to keep growing, and the area in front of this building wasn't designed for the traffic around the campus. This shed on the front was put on when the ski program began at the university, and it was designed primarily to house ski equipment. It was just supposed to be a cold shed. This one picture will serve as a symbol of all the meetings that have been going on for years and years in relation to the new building. We've had any number of consultants here. We've had grants from the National Endowment for the Arts to help us with
planning the environmental security situation. We've had grants, planning grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities to deal with the exhibit and collection programs. And this is just one of many meetings that have gone on, continuing to go on in relation to this. Many of these meetings resulted in a design program statement, which is what we had in hand when we decided that we needed the new building and to finally get it. This was a summary of all of the needs of the building, as determined by all of these committees and the staff. The Regents were offered a choice of sites on the campus that would be suitable for a new building. The one they chose was on this corner. It looks like a level field there, but it has a slope of about 8 feet from the back tree line to the road. The property was originally part of that lease to the Coast and Geodetic Survey, which is located here on the right-hand side of the slide, but it's been released by them for use for the museum building. The only dramatic feature of the site was the faculty, other people used going back and forth to the West Ridge. And we've tried to keep that in mind. One of the first things that was done was to, after the site was chosen by the Regents, was to test it to see that it was appropriate to build on. The other thing we did was run an archaeological survey on the site. We didn't want to find ourselves in the position of digging in an archaeological site and holding up construction. You can see a test hole here and a number of others that we set in a pattern all across that field to make sure that we were not interfering with an archaeological site. These are early drawings of the building. They're basically the same as the arrangement of space in the building is now, but the details have been changed. This is the upper level, or the public level. The building is in two levels. The lower one is primarily collections, research, and staff space. The upper level is primarily public space, which is what the public right now is within that building. It's oriented on the site. The path that I showed you on the view of the field two doors, two main doors to the building, and we hope that people will continue to use this as a route to the West Ridge, or perhaps give themselves enough time so they can stop and do something. As you come into the building, from either end, you like a large volume of awesome area has all the functions necessary to producing materials, speaking materials, producing materials, administrative offices, buildings that are very easily accessible to the public, conference classroom that can be used, school buildings, other small buildings. We'll find that we're especially interested in changing the buildings to provide materials not only from all of these collections I mentioned, but the conference shown. Permanent allow us to go into these collections and deal with some of this material. And we'll have a large lobby area where we can also be able to use it to be used as a gathering place. This is the architect's conception of what the view would be as you come in and you want to see the exhibit area that you're walking along. This is view of part of the bird range at the present time, located in the lower floor of the canal building here. These are cases with trays of bird specimens. They're similar ones from mammals down below. You can see they occupy a great deal of space. This kind of case is necessary to provide proper security for these materials, insects, and changes in the environmental situation. But they take a lot of space, particularly these aisles, to get everything we wanted in the new building. We thought we couldn't afford all the aisle space, and so we've gone to a compactor system. This is not the kitchen compactor kind of thing where you jam it all together, but this is now used in lots of libraries, being used more and more in museums. It's used in hospitals to store film. But there would be, under each of these rows of cases, a carriage which rides on tracks, and the row would be able to remove the next row. So you'd be bringing all the rows of cases together and eliminating all of the aisle space except for perhaps one or two aisles, which would then appear when you move them. By storing the materials in all of the collections together in this kind of a system, what we're able to do is store about 80% more material in the same space that we have to devote to collections. That system will
be located on the lower floor of all the lower ground itself.
Exhibit area. Within that large exhibit space, we'll find a little bit of circulation. Our approach to the exhibit is going to be to get away from the common breakdown and what we now use, having Eskimos over there, birds over there, and lots and other things. What we'll be dealing with is geographical areas in Alaska. We'll be treating the interior, southeastern Alaska, the Arctic, as entities. And within each of these, and devote a space. Within each of these areas, we'll find true relationships and bring things up a bit, so there's also the contemporary problems as well as showing the do that in different people, big numbers of models,
he's not talking into the mic.
Walk out there, make sure you can hear real well out there.
Yeah.
Other you can see these views are rather full of stone. You're not going to try for a very clean and open look. We hope it'll be very attractive and easy to use, but we also want to show as much material. This is taken about a month or so ago. The building has moved on quite a bit since that time. Most of it is now sheathed with its metal covering. Part of the building is all concrete, so the other part is not most of the machinery. In front of it, has been covered with this wing, and it's closed in and it continues.
We'll have our official opening.
a fraction of the floor space.
Wow, they see this is an older type. Newer types, I have a bunch of them there.
Thank you, Lou. If you have further questions, do get to Lou. I hope from this it will be helpful to you in instruction for use of materials, you in research, to know what is available, and as a help to all of us in helping to educate our fellow citizens, the public, in what a museum does, that the display area is just the tip of the iceberg, and welcoming them who have supported us so well in this program. Do get to Lou with further questions. Thank you, Lou. We appreciate it very much. I have three topics that I would like to say a few words on. One is planning, one is budget, and the other is enrollment. I must say that I can't help but begin with sharing with you the painful thought this morning that when I found out that I had not extended to you each an individual invitation today, but that the announcement had only gone out in the staff and faculty newsletter. And I'm sorry that we did not get out individual announcements. The air rests with me. I'd like to say a little bit about planning that has been going on. And to begin that, the other day I was walking across campus and met a colleague, and he said, "By the way, have you met the new academic vice president? What do you like?" And I said, "Well, I've been with him a little bit, and his basic reactions are sound. I'm so pleased that we have that type of leadership to look forward to. And he's with us today. I want you to make yourself acquainted with him and have him stand up so that you'll know who he is, Dr. Woodrow Thrombley, new academic vice president." I'd like to draw your attention to the colloquium that is being held tomorrow in this room, sponsored by the College of Environmental Sciences, on the role of science and research, with some star participants. If you haven't noticed in the bulletin, why, be sure and find out. And Dr. Alexander is here as dean of the college and can tell you details if you wish to know. In August 76, I asked each college, school, and unit to produce a list of high-priority items based on the academic development plan that they hope to give careful pursuit to in the academic year 76-77. Then last January, 78, I asked each unit to report on what they had accomplished and what they plan for in the future. On the basis of that, we then made an analysis of what we had accomplished and what remained to be accomplished in the academic development plan. I've often heard people say that it was a piece of paper of which turned out to be very little use. I beg to differ with that position. I think we've done more with it than some people know. We reviewed a total of 96 recommendations contained within the 1975 Academic Development Report. Of these recommendations, or their subsections, we believe that 35 have been accomplished. 40 are either partially completed or currently in the process of being accomplished, and 22 have not been accomplished. In addition, 10 of the 96 recommendations received no response to our request for status information. Highlights among those recommendations believed accomplished include the following: plans for a new university museum center, a major revision of the education development, a sharp curtailment in course proliferation through the use of a 3-year cycle for academic program planning, consolidation of Fairbanks campus housing under a director of housing, optional student health insurance, a new Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, the recent appointment of 3 permanent directors and division heads in the College of Environmental Sciences, which places strong emphasis on natural science programs, a new MS degree in natural resources management, a new cooperative fisheries agreement that establishes the Fairbanks campus as the center for all aspects of freshwater fisheries, biology, and management. The addition of fisheries oceanographers to the staff of the campus at Fairbanks, the expansion of the WAMI medical program to the fourth and final year, the transfer of the office administration program to TVCC, and the discontinuance of the baccalaureate program in this area, the development of a master's degree program in cross-cultural education, the establishment of a citizens advisory committee in the School of Education, and the new MS degree in Arctic engineering. It should be noted that several negative recommendations are considered accomplished since they have not been carried out. An example is the recommendation that several graduate programs not be established until the needs are apparent and the faculty is adequate. Also, it is noted that many recommendations for the continuation of existing programs are being carried out and thus are considered accomplished. These recommendations that we believe have not, or those recommendations that we believe have not been carried out, include the following. Adequate funding for binding of library periodicals. Improved educational delivery systems to improve the rural Alaskan life. Hiring of a residential hall program director. Divesting the dean of students with responsibility within the housing system. Reducing room rate for Fairbanks dormitories. Dropping of the master's degree program in mathematics. Development of a citizens advisory committee in natural resources management. Expansion of the WAMI program to include dentistry and or veterinary medicine, an associate level internship in Alaska business education, expansion of upper division and graduate offerings in engineering at Anchorage, development of an engineering research center, a continuing education program for Fairbanks area architects, consolidation of organizational units, the establishment of a council for the future, and a wider use of the citizens advisory groups. In some cases, organizational constraints have prevented the implementation of some suggested recommendations. In others, a lack of sufficient funding has been the cause. In still others, it has been felt that the recommendations were not necessary and or appropriate. In June 78, we have established a committee at the recommendation of the president to prepare an outline for a master planning for the university. That committee reported in 1st of September to the president, and on October 18th, we requested a statement of mission from each college and school and unit, which is due to be received the 1st of December. Or the 8th in some cases. This plan will is our first step in our master plan for the campus. On November 10th, the chancellors met with the academic vice president and went over an outline for the presentation or for the preparation of a master plan for the total university. I would like to share with you the basic parts of that outline. They are five. First, a statement of mission. Second, an environmental assessment. Third, goals and objectives. Fourth, internal strengths and capabilities. And fifth, setting program offerings and priorities. Now, the first three are ones that we are currently working on. Statement of mission, that is the educational philosophy. What are the basic values, the role of research, the role of instruction, the purposes of a liberal education, etc.? Role and scope, what are the boundary dimensions? Emphasis on undergraduate, graduate research, major constituents to be served, relative emphasis on teaching, research, and service, predicted enrollment patterns, relationship of campus to to the other parts of the system units, etc. That's what we're working on in terms of statement of mission. The second item, environmental assessment, that is external needs, opportunities, constraints. What are the social demographic characteristics of the serving area? Other institutions in the area, industry, education, government. The needs and resources in the area that present unique opportunities. What are the external constraints? And the third item, goals and objectives. Statements of intent, that is, what the institution hopes to accomplish, rather than how. Stated, where possible, in outcome-oriented terms. These three things we will have prepared to present to statewide by March 1st. We will then polish them, assimilate them, and hope to have their report by June ready for the board. I've appointed a committee to instigate and direct this, committee under the chairmanship of Dean Phillips, consisting of also of Dean Ray, School of Education, Dean Solder, College of Arts and Sciences, and Dr. Roeder, who will become Dean of the College of Environmental Sciences on the 1st of January. These three are responsible for directing the study and are now preparing the outline and program for a wide inclusion of participation throughout the campus and community in helping us prepare this master plan. We've got much of it done because we have kept up continuously in our planning process, as I indicated, what we've been doing over the last 3 years. But again, it is pulling it together, put it in a new form, give it meaning. Planning is for change. It's not in concrete. It's a thing that moves and changes. And there's some things, as I indicated before, that even though set as goals at one time, fade out and no longer become objectives. So will be this. The planning will be a continuous process. Just because we don't put in a blueprint and then build it as specifically as we build a museum building in all detail, doesn't mean it isn't worthwhile. I hope it will be a thing that will make us all alert to not only our own responsibilities, but those ways in which we can mesh and coordinate and cooperate with other units within the university. This committee has a tight schedule, and it will be interested in your input. They'll be seeking your input. They must seek ways in trying to involve as many meaningfully as they can. A few words on the budget. You must be living a bit of a charmed life because we found out that we met a certain crisis in our budget preparation this time. When we found out what was done to us with the library, we found out that we had a tremendous need, not only in our library, to secure funds for this year, right now, but also how to get it back into the system for next year, because it isn't in the maintenance budget section. We must do something to save the library from its situation. Second crisis was in the athletic program. Quite frankly, the athletic program, for a considerable period of time, has not been meeting the budget as the rest of us have, in this sense, that their deficit, when it occurred, was picked up from a magic package called end of the year fallout. I think we're all sort of acquainted with that old term. When I've discovered this, I was quite surprised. So I talked to the director, found out under the information, under the policy with which he had been operating, which was, quite frankly, here's your budget, build the best program you can build. But he says, what if I run over? Build the best program you can build. That's the only instructions you received. I couldn't believe it. So then I checked the fellow that John said gave these instructions, our good friend and former colleague Wendell Wolfe, who's now in Anchorage but was dean of the college at this time. And he said, yes, that's exactly the instructions he received as to how to run the program. Now, everyone else had been told to run the program within your budget or else. But they had been told, run the best program you can. And they did, and we're grateful for it. But there are no longer end-of-the-year fallouts, quite frankly. And I can't tolerate budgets being run over in that way. So I put a stop to it. Well, I brought the house down on top of my head because here, run a stop to it, but we've got a program and we've got commitments and we make these commitments 2 years in advance. We commit to student scholarships. We commit to other teams that we're going to play. So it isn't something that you just all of a sudden say, the game's off. Not at all. We've got long-range commitments within this program that we seek to achieve. So we wrote a new policy statement as to what the athletic program should be and got agreement with Anchorage that they agreed that this is the policy that the university should follow statewide, and we presented that to the president. We started from ground one, worked up. Now we've got that program which we're trying to carry out as best we can within the facilities. However, I've got a budget crisis at the time that I don't have enough money to meet these obligations to carry out to the end of the year, let alone the next. On top of that, the thing called the Blue and Gold Fund. This is income received from people who use the services, the equipment of the gymnasium, make a contribution to that, and that fund set aside, was supposed to be set aside for the recruitment of students. This is for in the athletic program. That was all that was to be used for. Under desperate situation, again using it for supplies and equipment. Because the program was not adequately financed at a most minimum level. This year, we made a bad estimate of the income on that. The income has fallen, we estimate, by $20,000. Pipeline is gone. Four swimming pools within the local area. Racket club court coming up. Unemployment. Well, we've got to find something in this case. So we found ourselves in a crisis situation. However, we live a charmed life. Our first priority in the budget this year had to be, by necessity, debt service, increased debt service in the physical plan, $277,000. We found out that that debt service is not going to come due the next budget year, but the year beyond. So I had found, all of a sudden, $277,000. For the preparation of the budget for next year, the 80 budget. Into that slot, I have moved $200,000 for the library and $77,000 for the athletic program. Neither of these sums is adequate for either of those activities. I should have had at least $90,000 for the athletic program, and $300,000 for the library. But the crisis, I think, was resolved of its crisis dimensions, at any rate. This then changed the priorities of the budget as I reported to you before. Because before I had reported to you, the budget emphasis was going to be first on implementing the new museum, staffing it, and supporting the College of Environmental Sciences, then the library. Now we have reshifted the priorities. So first will be the library and the athletic program. Fill in that slot that was already there. We couldn't increase the amount or decrease it. We had to have it by the exact amount of money, so that's how we moved into that position relative to the total university budget arrangement. Second in our priority now is the museum, the adequate supplying and staffing of the new museum. The third is to support the program in the College of Environmental Sciences. The fourth is the recruitment and relocation expenses, that is the bringing in of for the travel and household shipment of new employees and the shipping out expenses of those leaving. And the fifth is sabbatical support. I wanted you to know what the changes were, why they were, and how they came about. We can't have, in my mind, I don't want, and I've told the athletic group this too, I don't think it's right to put a coach in a situation to go out and recruit a young player to come. And then have to come, and when the player gets here and says, well, we're not going to do what we told you we were going to do. They can't continue in that role, which they've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years. Reneging on their promises, trying to backfill, trying to make go. All because nobody ever laid the budget out properly to support them the way they were told to run the program. Now, I think we have an understanding on that. We're going to support it adequately and properly. The minimum level we've agreed upon at present time. I hope in that way to in a way make us honest. Because in the past, that budget item has not met the priority role that it really played on campus because it was hidden in the end of the year fallout. And this, I might say, is not due to anything that's done in terms of the director of athletics. That program, they operated entirely according to the rules of the game and did it quite appropriately and well. One word about enrollments, if I may. From 77, fall of 77 to 78. Current figures show the University of Alaska Fairbanks with a very considerable across-the-board gains in full-time equivalent students, 18%. Credit hours up 19%. Headcount up 17%. Thought you would be interested in that. Some other things on enrollments, just to be sure that you keep the right perspective on. It's like sometimes we don't have the figures and know what it is. I think you should know that the University of Alaska at Anchorage has more graduate student credits than University of Alaska at Fairbanks by 14%. I think sometimes people get the idea that only Fairbanks has graduate students. Well, this is not so. Anchorage even has more in terms of student credit. When someone asks you, how many students do you have out there? What do you answer? I might be of help to you on that. We have 4,382 in headcount. So if you said 4,300 headcount, you'd be pretty close to it. Full-time equivalent, 2,600. Thought these figures might be of some interest to you. One of our concerns is retention of the students we've already got. May I encourage each of you at this time to say to that student, hope to see you back next semester. You'd be surprised how one little word can go a long, long ways of encouraging a doubtful mind. I wish you a smashing semester finish. A happy holiday. And I'll stick around for any questions, those that may have. Thank you for coming. Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what her name is. Oh, and that's the problem, that's the problem.